This is the London FinTech Podcast, bringing you practical insights and approaches, stories and inspiration from the innovators who are building the new world of financial services. Welcome to London FinTech Podcast for what may well be the last episode of 2025, where we are in the recording calendar, and perhaps also the first episode of 2026, as I think this is going to go out on the 1st of January. Anyway, this conversation is therefore aptly all about innovation and future focus, as we're going to be talking about crypto lending. And I'm joined today by Sid Powell. Sid is the CEO and co-founder of Maple Finance. They're the leading on-chain asset manager for institutional credit. And Sid is going to explain to us what that all means, how it all works, and why it's different and interesting alongside all the other things that are going on in the crypto landscape at the moment. Welcome, Sid.
Thanks for having me on, Tony. Glad to be here.
Good to see you. So can you tell us a bit about your background before Maple, so folks know a little bit about you and what built, led up really to creating the Maple business?
Yeah, definitely. So my background was finance and banking. So in a prior life, I was based in Australia. I used to work at National Australia Bank in the securitization team. So this meant doing asset-backed securities and bonds. So our clients were mainly home loan lending companies, loan lending companies, credit card companies. And after I'd been in there for a couple of years, I went to a smaller lending company because I wanted to get a taste of what it was like being at a startup. So I went from a 10,000 person organization to a 40 person organization. And I ran the treasury there, helped set up a securitization facility for them. And then that was actually where I met my co-founder, Joe. And then from there, we started thinking about, whether we could do tokenized bonds and lending on chain. And that was really the genesis of the idea for Maple. So those conversations started happening all the way back in 2018. And then it was in 2019 that we sort of first put pen to paper and actually started working on Maple.
Yeah. So coming from a traditional lending background with a big institution to, I think you said 40 head organization, where presumably you were pretty much writing all the paperwork and running the finances and the deal flows yourself. And then looking forward to how do we put this on chain? Okay. So what was the catalyst for that? So, hey, we should do this. We should do this on blockchain. Well, what was the spark of inspiration?
Well,
there?
I mean, when I was in banking, I was always very skeptical of blockchain because it was oppositional to us. The idea was that, blockchains were going to disrupt banks. And so I didn't like that from the competitive seat at the bank. However, when I went to the smaller lending company, I was then a client of the banks. And I think the most interesting part for me was effectively the idea that you could program everything that we used to have teams of people doing somewhat manually when I was on the banking side. And the idea that I saw was that you could open up capital markets to smaller companies. So you didn't have to have a minimum of $100 or $200 million worth of loans to start doing tokenized bonds. I foresaw a world where you could do that with $5 or $10 million. So it would help smaller companies scale up faster and in a way kind of democratize, I hate the overuse of the word democratize, but effectively make capital markets accessible for smaller, growing, innovative companies. And the idea was that we would be able to use smart contracts to automate everything that we'd been doing manually in the banks. That was kind of the initial idea. But I mean, more broadly, you kind of know if you want to do a startup and then you're kind of a hammer looking for a nail. So I was, from my time in the bank, I was kind of on the lookout for what's an idea that I could take and turn into a startup. And so this, this happened to be a trend that I saw that I could see lasting for, years and really disrupting finance.
I love that. So, and I was first introduced to the concept of smart contracts on the Ethereum network about 10 years ago and a bit of a head scratch at the time as to, how are you going to use this? And so sort of quite early on, really focusing that in on a very real use case, borrowing, lending money, and how you do that without all the paperwork and you do it real time. And we're going to talk about all of that in a minute when we get into a bit more about what Maple's actually doing. But just before we do that, I would love to get your perspective on the market, on the crypto market right now. There's so much going on out there. I've had Franklin Templeton on this show. I've had Solana on this show. And we've talked about the uptake in stable coins. We've talked about digitizing real world money market funds, all sorts of things. And there are so many different angles beyond the pure speculation on whether it's Bitcoin or your favorite meme token 100%. Or whatever it is that's going on out there. Where do you see the crypto market right now?
So I think the crypto market's maturing. You know, for the longest time, we've all been in this paradigm of four-year cycles where price, you know, every 4 years, in line with Bitcoin halving, prices will rise and then they'll pull back. And I think we're approaching now kind of a level of maturity and institutional adoption where we are sort of getting out of that. You know, you can't expect the same kind of gains that you've had in the past from Bitcoin. But the flip side of that is that you won't, in my view, you won't experience, you know, 80% drawdowns the way that you used to a few years ago. So my take on the crypto market is that it's maturing. There's a lot of institutional adoption. You can see that in the Bitcoin ETFs, the large fund managers now recommending that their clients hold some portion of assets in crypto as a bit of a hedge against inflation and a non-correlated return. And then broadly, the stuff that I'm very excited about and that's very impactful for where Maple wants to go is things like stablecoins. So the Genius Act in the US, we've seen PayPal, Stripe, all enter the kind of the stablecoin markets. What I look at as we look in 2026 is kind of three big trends: stablecoin adoption and proliferation, which is going to help a company like Maple because we lend in stablecoins; asset tokenization, so funds, equities, property, real estate, all coming into tokenized form, which can then serve as collateral for crypto-backed. The inbound adoption and participation of institutions. So JP Morgan, I think interestingly last week, did a arranged debt issuance for Galaxy, which happened on the Solana blockchain. And then, as I said, Stripe is coming in and doing stablecoins. Robinhood wants to tokenize equity. So those three trends, stablecoin adoption, tokenization of assets, and institutional participation, I think are going to be the big catalysts for 2026 and 2027.
Yeah, and when I was talking to Sandy Call about this from Franklin, she was really very clearly framing as the next 50 years of finance. And it does feel like the financial institutions are really on board at scale and in many cases now leading with blockchain-based architectures and products.
Yeah.
So it's going to be really fascinating to see how this scales out from now.
In your journey,
when I think you said you started in 19, did you know you were on something immediately? It's like, this is a good idea and this is going to fly from the outset? Or do you feel that it's been more of a slow build up? And I know the market's been through some crypto winters and some ups and downs along the way. But did you know you were on something right at the beginning?
It's a good question. I think initially with any new sort of venture or idea, you go through this initial peak of euphoria, let's call it a local high. And then you realize it's much harder than what you initially thought. And then you go through the trough of despair. And so I'd say initially I thought it could be a huge idea. And then a few months in, I encountered the reality of people telling me that it was too early and much more difficult than we thought it would be. And then, you know, and then we went through the trough of despair. But I think the thing is, you just keep going and you just keep pushing ahead and you know that you have a North Star. And for me, I still always saw, even in the trough of despair, I still saw the impending logic that eventually all finance would go onto blockchain rails because it's faster, it's globally accessible, it's more cost effective. And so I always maintained the North Star that I could see that's where it was going. We would just have to navigate a few swamps and pitfalls along the way. But I've definitely, you know, and then subsequent to that, we then had 2020, everything collapsed and we had to kind of get through that period as well. So there's definitely been a lot of ups and downs, but I would say I always had the North Star that this is where finance is going longer term. And to your point about your conversation with Sandy, it is going to be multi-decade. I mean, imagine if you got into the internet in the mid-90s and you said, well, I think this will peak in 2005. I mean, you know, here we are in 2025 and the internet's still growing at a massive clip.
So despite the fact that at the time of this conversation, you know, price of Bitcoin is down and various analysts are saying that there's going to be a massive drop off, presumably you're still bullish and we're just going to trade through this?
Well, I think so. I think Bitcoin, you know, Bitcoin went from in 2021, 2022, it went, you know, 65, 70K was the all-time high. And then it drew right back down to sub 20 or thereabouts. And then, you know, here we are this year, we saw a new all-time high of 120. So I think it will just continue plowing through. Fortunately, to be bullish on Bitcoin, you have to be somewhat bearish on the structural, you know, Western financial system. And I do think, you know, we've seen governments can't contain their spending, right? So Bitcoin is a debasement trade. Governments will continue printing money, being in debt. And unfortunately, the problem with democracy is that everybody votes themselves free things and you have to pay for those somehow. So if you pay for it with inflation, Bitcoin will continue to rip.
Okay. Well, we're not just here to talk about the price of Bitcoin. So we're here to talk about on-chain lending. So just to come back to Maple, and I think I'm right in saying that your assets under management or your lending book, I guess, at this stage is north of $4 billion.
That's right.
Pretty significant numbers. Sort of what stage of the business do you feel you're at the moment? Is this to plan, or are you ahead at this point? And I wonder what the ambition looks like looking forward.
Well, I think the thing about being an entrepreneur at a startup is you always have to keep shifting. As soon as you hit a stretch goal, you just have to shift and lengthen it out. So the horizon always has to be exactly that. It has to be kind of further out on the horizon. So I would say we're a bit behind where we would like to be, but our ultimate ambition is that, you know, we think our lending book can grow to hundreds of billions of dollars. And I would say right now we're about fourth globally. So if you look, there's Tether, Nexo, and Galaxy ahead of us. We have assets under management of north of $4 billion. We run around $1.5 billion of loans today. If you look, so one, we have a lot of room to catch up just to get to the number one spot, which is $18 billion. However, the trend I see is Bitcoin market cap's about $2 trillion. We're at around $25 billion worth of Bitcoin-backed lending out there at the moment. So it's a little over 1%. That's very low compared to equities. And so my view is that if Bitcoin can double again over the next few years to $4 trillion, I don't see why you can't get to a level of lending against Bitcoin of, say, 5%. To that point, you're looking at a $200 billion outstanding market. So where we want to go, I often talk to people and say, our North Star is kind of being like the Apollo of on-chain credit. We think there's a clear trend where private credit will grow. However, it will transition to being on-chain, taking place in stablecoins. And so I ultimately look at their AUM of $650 billion and say that's ultimately where we want to go. And that's the position that we want to supplant in 10 or 20 years from now.
No shortage of ambition there, or addressable market based on that analysis. So let's talk about what Maple actually is there. So what is on-chain asset management, on-chain lending, and certainly the Maple model for that?
The simplest way to describe the product that we do at the moment, Tony, is to say that we do collateralized loans or secured loans to institutions. So we would do loans anywhere from 10 million up to north of 100 million. Our clients are typically trading firms, prime brokers, asset managers, family offices, and ultra high net worths. We lend to them stablecoins. So I lend USDC or USDT. They post collateral to us in the form of Bitcoin, ETH, Solana, or XRP. So we really just try and focus on the large cap crypto assets. And the reason we do that is they have the best liquidity. So if we get into a pickle or a volatile market like we saw on October 10th, we have very liquid assets that we can instantly sell without too much slippage. And then our clients use the proceeds of our loans for trading activity, asset management. They might use it for real estate investments, but they use it ostensibly for business purposes. So that's our core product. So we are, in a sense, private credit taking place on chain. The on-chain aspect of asset management for me means transparency. So we issue all of our loans using smart contracts, liquidity, in that we can get a loan to a client anywhere in the world. So I can lend to a firm in Japan as easily as I can lend to one in New York or in London or in Singapore. And it's a little bit like Netflix. You remember, Netflix had zero marginal cost of new customer. So you could stream Netflix in Japan or Singapore or London, whereas Blockbuster had to set up physical infrastructure in those countries. And so it was slower and more costly to market. I look at the traditional finance players, and if I was to do private credit in Japan as one of those asset managers, I have to go and set up infrastructure and bank accounts, whereas Maple can just send a loan to a trading firm in Japan, you know, with effectively zero marginal costs. So I view that as a huge advantage. But ostensibly, on-chain means transparency, liquidity, global access, and ultimately composability. If you look at our products, if you have a lending position on Maple, you can take that position, you can use it as collateral to borrow, you can fix the interest rate, or you can exit and enter on a secondary market.
And so is there any fiat currency involved at all? So this is...
None. It's all stable coins. And I think the reason is, if you told me tomorrow that I had to start up a private credit fund to go and compete with Apollo, Ares, Blackstone, unless I have some kind of technology advantage, I'm starting significantly behind. They have a 30-year head start on me. So what do I, you know, what have we tried to do? We've tried to capture what we think is the next big technology wave, which is all lending and borrowing over the next 20 years, like, or in 20 years' time, will all take place in stable coins, in my view. And it will all settle on a blockchain. So I'm trying to use, I'm trying to ride a new wave to get a, you know, to get the edge on those competitors. And that's why we don't touch fiat, really.
Yeah. So to what extent are your borrowers and your lenders already crypto native? So, or do you spend some of your time really talking to TradFi treasuries and corporate financiers and sort of getting them onto the chain?
It's a very good question. I do talk to TradFi treasuries, asset managers, insurance companies, large fixed income investors, because I view it as, you know, we have to educate them before they're going to transact with us.
Yeah.
But I think 2026 would be the year that we would, you know, that we would plan to get TradFi companies involved in what we do. Thus far, all of our borrowers have effectively been crypto native companies, because in a lot of instances, they're doing trading. Our lenders are typically crypto native, but we're starting to see more interest from folks who are not already handling stablecoins or using crypto. The catalyst, in my view, is I come from a securitization background. Securitization is in our company's DNA. And so we're currently working on our first securitization transaction at the moment. And what we would like to do is set up a securitization warehouse that we can get rated by S&P or Moody's or one of the ratings agencies. And then I think if we can, over time, secure an investment grade rating, then we'll be able to fit within the mandate of traditional fixed income investors. And so that's the next leg of growth, is we have very good representation in DeFi and among crypto clientele. However, the biggest balance sheet is TradFi asset managers, but you got to meet them where they are, which means a rating, some, you know, like the traditional documentation and subscription agreements they see. It's just when they invest next year, what will be happening is they'll effectively be investing in a portfolio of stablecoin loans backed by...
And your lenders, so we've seen the biggest banks coming out with their own stablecoins. And do lenders include the big banks, the big FIs? Are they saying, hey, look, I can get that yield on my loan if I put some money into Maple? Is that a thing at this point, or it's more alternate other sources of...
We would look at structured facilities with them. So the issue is that big banks are going to have punitive regulatory capital treatment. Reg cap treatment effectively kept all of the banks out of private credit for a long time and created the shadow banking sector. And so if you want to access bank capital, you have to do it through structured SPVs and warehouse facilities, so securitizations. So that's where we would look to kind of engage banks. It's also a competitive protection for us, right? Like, banks are going to struggle to do Bitcoin-backed loans for a while, because it's just going to get very bad regulatory capital treatment for a long time. So it both protects us, but also slows our engagement with banks. But that's where I would see it going over a period of time.
Yeah, and what's your position on lending risks? So your lenders are institutions, certain types of institutions we've just been talking about. And I think I had a quick look before we started recording. I think you offer sort of 8.7% APR, and you talk about over-collateralized loans. And so that's a good return. But also, how do you answer the question about, is my money safe?
So a typical vanilla loan we would do would be about a 70% LTV against Bitcoin. So let's say somebody gives me $10 million worth of, or let's just say $100 million worth of Bitcoin. I would give them a $70 million loan. What I do is I layer in triggers. So at 80% LTV, if Bitcoin drops, I then margin call them and I ask them for either more Bitcoin or a repayment on the loan. And I give them about 24 hours to do that. If it continues to drop and goes to, say, 85% LTV, I have stop loss triggers. So at that point, it's just an instant event of default and we start liquidating the Bitcoin. However, because our clientele is institutional, we don't nuke all of the Bitcoin. just sell them. We do a soft liquidation. We sell them back to their 70% level. So the risk is very centered around collateral risk as opposed to counterparty risk. We still do a counterparty credit DD because we prefer our clients to always be able to top up or pay down the loans. We don't want to have to liquidate them. It's kind of bad for business, bad for our reputation. So I would say for a lender or somebody looking at the APY, effectively what you're taking is you're taking a little bit of career risk because your colleagues in traditional finance probably yes. still think Bitcoin is a bit stupid. And you're taking a bit of a liquidity premium risk in that this is still a small area and so it's undersupplied capital. So the borrowers have to kind of overpay for it at the moment. I think over time it will normalize more towards investment grade returns. But at the moment, I think one of the really appealing things is it pays north of what junk credit does. However, junk credit is largely unsecured and subordinate, whereas here you have senior first ranking security over very liquid collateral that substantially over collateralizes your loan position.
Yeah, and that
I think it's a very attractive risk return on that.
And for Maple, of course, those liquidation frameworks are programmed. That's the smart contract, presumably. So you're on the right side of that at all times. So if the price of the collateral is dropping in the market, then to your point, you can sell into it, sell out at various thresholds so that you maintain your LTV. Yes. So I can see the structure very well. Look,
I said an 85% LTV. I still have a pretty substantial buffer before I hit, the first dollar of impairment.
Yeah. It's a smart model. So what else is different about Maple? So again, you said that some other people are doing this. You're the fourth largest, I think you said. But how do you stand out and how are you going to become number one?
So I think some of the reasons I think we're well positioned to try and go for that number one spot. We are of the top three or of the top four. We're probably the only pure play lending business. If you look, Tether, number one, obviously stablecoin, stablecoin issuer is their primary business. Galaxy has an OTC desk. They have trading activities. They have staking activities. They do some crypto mining. So they are a diversified financial. And then if you look at Nexo, similar, they have multiple business units, whereas we are a pure play lender. So I do think focus gives us an edge. And what we try and do is we try and compete on speed, flexibility on commercial terms. So we will try and do more bespoke structures to kind of meet our clients' needs, whether that's onboarding a new custodian, fixed term, shorter dated. We can try and flex there in a way that our counterparties are a little bit more rigid because this is just one of their business lines. It's not the main business line of theirs. So very often we will win a deal because another prospective client is still onboarding with one of our competitors, whereas we can quote and settle the loan to them in that, in the same time it takes them to onboard with one of our competitors. So I think speed is very important. And then I would say our unique moat is that we are the only one of the top 10 lenders who have integrations with DeFi. So of all of those CeFi players, they're all very segmented, whereas we've actually been able to raise capital from DeFi. So it gives us a structurally lower cost of capital than most of our competitors. Enables us to undercut them on pricing.
Before we jump right into today's episode, a quick thank you to our sponsor, NextWave. NextWave is an award-winning consultancy that is helping many of the world's leading banks, investment managers, and insurers deliver on their growth, efficiency, risk, and control goals and transform their businesses. With a senior team who have come from MD-level positions in major firms like HSBC, Barclays, and UBS, NextWave has both the deep industry expertise and the hands-on capabilities in AI, data, and automation to drive real results. More business outcomes and less PowerPoint from the consulting experience, as their clients like to say. NextWave has moved 2-week manual processes to 5-minute agentic automations, rescued global banking regulatory control programs, and digitized deal platforms, sustainability, and regulatory reporting systems. And they do much of this with hands-on engineering capabilities on leading technologies, which include ServiceNow, Alteryx, Quantexa, and Komunda. So if a modern and specialist alternative to the big brand consulting model sounds appealing, one which covers the full life cycle of strategy specialists and solutions, but with small practitioner teams, rapid delivery, and a better price point, then perhaps you should talk to NextWave. Visit nxwave.com to find out more and get in touch. That's nxwave.com. All right, let's get back to the episode. I want to talk a little bit about the growth journey you're on. We've already established that your sort of North Star target is in the tens, if not hundreds of billions. So there's plenty of runway ahead and plenty of ambition. But you've been doing this now for 7 or 8 years. And, you know, what have you learned on that founder journey? Was that literally, you know, a day one kitchen table type business plan and you've been bootstrapping from there? But I'm curious, what's the journey you've been on so far and what have you learned along the way?
I've learned a lot of things along the way. If I had to boil it down to sort of, you know, maybe the two or three most important things, I think it's important to get a small number. It's important to be right on a small number of decisions. You don't need to be overactive. If you make a few good business decisions, they kind of carry most of the weight. So I would say try and do less things, but do them better. You know, most of the success we're now enjoying is because of the decision to do over-collateralized lending, whereas initially we were doing unsecured lending back in 2021, 2022, and then to go for vertical integration. So I'd say as a founder, I very much emphasize vertical integration for new founders. I think if you try and be a platform company, you actually leak a lot of power away for pricing, speed to market. And then the other thing I would say is in terms of dealing with clients and negotiation, it's always better to leave a little bit of a little table. You want to be in an area where the pie is growing for everyone, and therefore you can afford to be a little bit less greedy. And those partnerships, you really want to set them up for the long term. So I think that's very different to being in a mature industry where it's a little bit more of a zero-sum game. But I would say that's one of the things I've learned in negotiations along the way. And it's probably a few decisions that kind of carry most of the weight. And the other thing is you can't control, basically every 2 to 3 years you have a crisis of some kind and you can't control what form it's going to come in, but you just have to keep gritting your teeth and soldier through. And that grit will carry you a lot of the way. You know, that's probably actually the most important thing. And then the other thing I would say, one more thing, is if you're in a lending business, your primary duty is probably risk management. We don't get paid, as Howard Marks says, we don't get paid for hitting home runs. We get paid for missing the losers or the bad deals. So you really have to, like concentrate on risk management. And that means using SPVs, collateral monitoring, that type of thing.
Yeah. I love that. When you ask a founder, what have you learned in the last 7 years on your startup? And they say there's three things, you just know there's going to be a fourth.
I learned I shouldn't quote numbers of things before I start talking.
You'd run out of fingers.
Yeah.
It's always the way. But there's there's a maturity in there as well, though. That strategic thinking about always leave something on the table, build for future scale. It's not just about the transaction in the moment and be ready for the shock that's around the corner, because you don't know what it's going to be, but you can bet your boots there's going to be one in every two or 3 years.
100%. And I think, the most important, entrepreneur I kind of look to for inspiration, I think, is John D. Rockefeller. And if you look at his rise, he often overpaid for mergers or acquisitions or things like that. But he viewed it as leaving a little bit on the table and kind of not creating enemies as they grew. You know, whereas convention would say, no, you need to get the absolute lowest price. You need to like really drill your competitors. But I think the way he approached partnerships and competition is very instructive for founders today.
Yeah. And you talked about making good decisions and a couple of examples there about your sort of pivoting your business model as being great decisions that are underpinning your growth currently. What are some of the bad decisions you took?
It's a good question. I think, we had to get a foothold in the market. So in 2021, 2022, when we were doing under collateralized lending, like I don't begrudge that decision because I think we would have had trouble getting into the market. However, in hindsight, in hindsight, obviously it carried more risk than over-collateralized lending. I think probably trying to do too many things at once. There have been times where we've tried to have, five major projects on the go. Really, we probably should have just had 1 to 2. So I think that's one. Choosing bad partners. I think you should always spend a little bit of extra time due diligencing your potential partners because you want to have a long-term relationship with them. And I think, we've seen this year, we had a couple of partners who, in hindsight, I think they were regrettable decisions to enter into relationships with them. And so I think you should always take a little bit more time in due diligencing your partners to work out if it's a fit or not. Most of the problems you encounter, I think, are people related.
Yeah, it's true. When you lock into your team and your alliances,
you can't do a good deal with bad people at the end of the day.
No. Very interesting. Yeah. Okay. So, and I spoke to Ben Brophy on the show a couple of months back, European lead at Solana, and I was saying, "Hey, how big are you? Where's HQ?" And it's a decentralized setup. So he said, "Well, I don't actually have an office in London."
Yeah. Yeah.
Seriously, what's fastest blockchain? So for those of us coming from traditional corporate world, there's a few things to get your head around. Is that the case for Mayport? Are you guys all sort of spread all over the world, or are we
spread out. We don't have a single sort of corporate HQ. We have offices in New York, Florida, London, and Dubai, and actually Barcelona. So what I would say is these are almost decentralized. I hate overusing the word decentralized, but it's like, think of these as like offices where we have, you know, anywhere from 4 to 7 people. And I like that because it allows people to still work together. I don't love the idea of a fully remote organization where everybody's just in their house. I think you do get a lot of benefit out of serendipitous communication and camaraderie from being in the same office. However, we don't have one HQ, you know, a single HQ. So I think we're kind of in between. We're not fully remote, but we're not all in a single office.
Okay.
If I had my way, I would probably prefer people to be in a single office rather than fully remote. I think it just makes a big difference for work ethic and camaraderie.
Yeah. Are you flying around a lot?
I do. Yeah. So I go up to New York every, you know, I'm based in Florida, but I go up to New York every sort of 4 to 5 weeks. I travel to conferences and go and sort of spread the gospel of Maple. And then, you know, I'll do flights to sort of see our major clients and get some FaceTime with them. I still, you know, coming from a TradFi background, I still really emphasize the importance of getting face-to-face meetings with your major clients.
And what are your thoughts looking to the next year? Well, as I said, at the time of publishing this, perhaps it'll be the first day of 2026, but your predictions for 2026, other than another 10 billion in deposits for Maple, what's your prediction for the sector?
Good question. Look, I think Bitcoin will ultimately have a reasonably strong year next year. So I know we don't love talking about price, but I'd still think Bitcoin's probably going to be closer to 150K than where it is today. I think it'll benefit from, you know, some dovish Fed policy. But on the broader crypto front, I think you'll get the market structure bill in the US, so the Clarity Act, and I think that will really open floodgates for more institutional participation, because it just gives clarity, excuse the pun, but it gives you a lot of clarity and transparency around what does a tokenized security look like? What kind of disclosures do you need to produce if you're a startup? A lot of the costs that were keeping startups away from the American market in crypto before, where it was kind of this unquantifiable cost. You didn't know how much you were going to have to spend on compliance, but you knew that the old SEC was probably going to say that it wasn't enough. So I think the new SEC administration has been very, or leadership team has been very forthright in engaging with the industry and in trying to put forward innovation. So I think the Clarity Act is going to be a massive driver of new institutional participation. I think you could see stablecoin circulating supply get to north of 400 billion over the next year. Like, I think that's going to continue to grow structurally.
What's coming next for Maple, if you can say at this stage?
Well, one of the big things we're working on is that securitization deal. So I would love to start engaging ratings agencies next year for that. We will be expanding on more chains. So we've had very successful partnerships and rollouts with Aave and Morpho and the Sky ecosystem. So we're looking at what chains would we go to next year. We also want to expand those DeFi partnerships. That's been a huge driver of growth in Q4 for us. So things like, you know, partners like Aave, the Sky ecosystem, expect to see more of those coming in 2026. But me being, you know, being TradFi and securitization background, that's probably what I'm most excited about personally.
Okay, sticking to the script a bit.
And look forward to our goal for next year would be, we want to hit around 100 mil ARR or recurring revenue. So we're at around 25 to 30 mil today. So we'd be looking to roughly try and 4x the business next year.
So I think that maybe they call that a centaur status at that point. You're no longer a unicorn.
Not quite a unicorn, but yeah, there you go.
Look, we're going to time out in a few minutes. short and sharp, this conversation, at least for me anyway. Sometimes I go on a bit, but it's been absolutely fascinating. And sort of in closing, takeaways for the audience, is there anything that you're reading or listening to right now that's really giving you pause for thought that you'd recommend to the audience?
Yeah. In terms of favorite podcasts, I really like Founders Podcast. Is fantastic.
This one, obviously.
This podcast in it and Founders Podcast. I like reading and listening to biographies. So I just finished a audiobook on the Portuguese Empire and this guy Afonso de Albuquerque who sort of built their empire in the Indian Ocean. And I was reading a biography called Augustus by Anthony Everett that I thought was very good. So I highly recommend it. It's kind of short, but gets into like the personality of the first Roman Empire. So I like the I like the biographies.
So apart from reading biographies and history, I sometimes ask these people right at the top of the show what they do when they're off duty, but I skipped over that one. So I'm going to ask you in closing, what do you do when you're not running Maple and you just want to sort of decompress?
So I have a one-year-old daughter, so she keeps me pretty busy. And I grew up playing a lot of tennis. Yeah. However, since I've moved to Florida, the big game is padel, which is like a cross between tennis and squash or tennis and racquetball. And yeah. I've been getting really into that, so it's a good social game, keeps me pretty fit. And then otherwise I do sort of running and running in gym. In my spare time, but padel is probably the main sort of sport I've picked up since I've been here.
I love that. It's a craze in London as well, but it's called paddle.
And that's the big
tomato
question.
Tomato moment there. Padel.
Yeah.
We had someone on the other week was talking about pickleball as well, and I still haven't worked out quite what that is.
I can't believe how quickly they've grown. When I first got to Miami, 3 years ago, and I think there were two clubs. Now there's probably 12 to 15. Yeah.
And it's really expensive. So there's paddle clubs in Canary Wharf and various places, and it's about four times as expensive as hiring a tennis court. So somewhere, paddle rackets are not cheap.
Yeah, yeah. If you play in New York, it's about $150 for an hour.
There you go.
Yeah.
Crikey. So you have to play doubles and turn up with some people
who've got
a few Bitcoin to pay for it. Right, there you go.
Yeah.
Sid, if folks want to find out more about Maple or get in touch with you, where do they go?
So they can head to our website. It is maple.finance, or we're pretty active on social media. So on X, it's at maplefinance, one word, and then I am at Syrup Sid. So feel free to give me a follow or reach out to us. We also have a contact us page on the website.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, love what you're doing with pushing the envelope on on-chain lending. And for those of you in the TradFi audience, hopefully you've been able to keep up and learn something as well. For those of you in the sort of crypto native audience, maybe you've heard some of this before, but it's really great to hear the growth stories and some of the things that you've learned along the way. I think you've really sort of picked up on some very important cornerstones of the growth curve and the growth experience. And it sounds like there's a lot ahead of you. So I wish you all the very best.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Tony. This was great.